Okay, we're about to get started. We're just coming up on the final minute. So I'd like to welcome everybody to the September meeting of the Ottawa PC News Group. If we have any guests with us tonight, welcome. We welcome guests at any time at Ottawa PC News Group meetings, either the general meeting or the weekly Q&A sessions, which are also held on Wednesday evenings at 7:30. If you want to become a member, we'd welcome you to join in. It's only $20 a year. However, it's not mandatory in order to be able to attend meetings. Okay, so our agenda tonight, this is one of our more, I think, more fun meetings. We have them periodically, try to have them at least once a year, sometimes twice a year. And that's members' favorites, where any of our members can step forward and share something that they find particularly interesting or fun or useful, be it software, hardware, or services. And this round, we have five people that are going to give presentations. We're going to be starting off with Tom Trache, and he's going to be giving a presentation on FUBAR 2. Oh, that should be 2000, not 200, dealing with locally stored music and audiobooks. He'll be followed by Alan with a presentation on spiders, scrapers, crawlers, and bots, talking about web scraping technologies. And Bob Harris will be following with a fun bit on doing Bitmoji for Windows, how to personalize yourself in your messaging and so forth. Tim Hillock will be giving a presentation on genealogy, and I'll be wrapping it up with doing something on photo restoration. And I'm going to, again, if I can find my controls properly, I am muting all. People will not have the ability to unmute themselves, just so that we can keep control on things. Feel free to use the chat window for any comments or questions. We will open it up in between each of the presentations so that people will be able to unmute themselves. And at that point, you can either continue through the chat, or you could just unmute yourself and ask her a question audibly or make a comment audibly. And hopefully we'll have some time after the final presentation for a bit of an all-round Q&A session on all of the presentations. Reminder to all of our presenters, you will have to unmute yourself. And with that, I would like to kick it over to Tom Trache, and I'm going to stop my sharing. And I'll kick it over to Tom to share his screen and take on the first presentation. Take it away, Tom.
Okay. Here I am. And share. Okay. FUBAR 2000 is basically an audio manager, similar to, I guess, Calibre for ebooks and Lightroom for audio. So this is kind of a Lightroom for audio. You manage files and you can do certain stuff to them. And if I can, there. So what can it do? It can play almost anything. It can rip audio files from a variety of sources. It can manipulate them. It can do a variety of simple tagging, and it's very configurable. It's easy. It also has an easy, fast, and powerful search and filter. So you can take a look at everything you have and put in a filter, whatever it is. It could be just a simple word, which is what I always use. But you can also do logical and arithmetic combinations, like title contains this, something like that. So you can really manage your audio files, assuming you have put words in as tags for descriptions. It can play almost any file, waves, MP3s, MP4s, blah, 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 blah. You can also rip them. Everything you can play, you can rip. You can copy an album art, playlist too, when you're doing your ripping. It can be lossy or lossless, so you can rip to to FLAC and other lossless things, or you can do it to MP3s, which are lossy. And you can do a variety of things like skipping silence, tempo switch, equalization, level adjust, and change the channel count. So it gives you quite a few tools to work with. One of the things that audiophiles have is a level. And one of the things that QLR 2000 can do is to calculate that level, or take a look at it and see what the level is. And this is can be put into a a way of changing the level, so you can move it up, move it down, louder, softer, and you can normalize track's loudness. And when I rip audiobooks, I normalize them to a certain loudness so that they I don't have to change the settings on my player when I play them. So this is the replay gain. You can scan the replay gain. Basically calculates what the average sound is, as well as the peak. And you can scan per file, scan an album, because you can store this replay gain for a particular track or for a whole album. Actually, not or, but and. So the album has a particular replay gain, and you can scan as albums, in other words, multiple, if you're scanning multiple albums. And you can also remove the replay gain, which I've never ever done, and you can apply gain to file content. If you do apply gain, then you can specify what your target volume is. So you can make files louder or quieter. You can lower the adjustment to prevent clipping. And this is a very useful thing I use to, especially for audiobooks. I don't generally use it for other kinds of music. So ripping audiobooks, one of the things that audiobooks usually have is that they're usually done at about 64 kilobits per second using CBR, which is constant bit rate, and they take up a whole bunch of room. They're also usually done in stereo rather than mono, and yet the tracks, both stereo signals are the same. So what I usually do when I rip audiobooks is I play them faster, I skip any silences, and I reduce the bandwidth to 8 kilohertz. And this is how I do it. I highlight the tracks I want to change. I check, I click convert. When I click convert, I get this thing, this particular window, and there's an output format, a destination, processing, and other. And processing, I download mix channels to mono. I skip the silence. And I increase the tempo. In other words, I make it faster without increasing the hertz. It doesn't sound squeaky like this. It sounds normal but faster. And when that's done, I replay gain. I replay gain them, so that actually sets a replay gain tag in the audio file. I transfer any tags the audio file has. I copy other files, and these are the files I copy. Other JPEGs, which are basically usually album art. WAX is a playlist, which actually gives sub-segments within the audiobook, and a variety of other files that are associated with audio files. And then in this converter setup, this is the output format. I choose MP3 lane, and this is how I choose a particular way I'm reducing the size of the file and converting it to an MP3 lane. It's what's called as, I don't know, an autonym, because it stands for lane is not a media encoder, which of course it is. And this is the, these are the settings I use in LAME. This is actually the settings that I use, and these are the things that are displayed here. And this is a lossy signal, and it's, I have highest bits per second mode supported is 8 kilohertz. And to go into more detail, this is what I use for audiobooks. V9, that's basically the highest compression. Mono, resample 8, which is 8 kilohertz, rather than the 44 of a CD, for example. High pass 20, which reduces the bass, which I find to be usually excessive in audiobooks. Q0 is maximum quality. Priority 1 is minimum priority, which is actually idle priority in Windows. Okay. S is Sir Silent, and %D is a placeholder for the file name. So that's what I use for audiobooks. It also, Kubar 2000 also has a variety of MP3 utilities. You can optimize the file layout. I'm not sure what that means. You can also minimize the file size. You can fix any VBR headers. You can rebuild the stream. You can also save as playlists, which obviously if you have selected a couple of files or more. Regarding file layout, MP3 files in particular are composed of not only the audio frames, but also the tags. And I'm not sure what else is also included, but Optimize presumably makes it better when you play them back. You can also edit and add tags to audio files. For example, this file, I can change any of these things, and here I can add new tags. So there's a UPC. These are kind of standard artists down to comment, and sometimes they're filled in and sometimes they aren't. You can add them in. Date is usually a year, genre is whatever you want to say, performer, etc., etc. So here I'm adding in Beethoven as the composer for this particular, or these particular files. There's two files here. There's one this and another later on. You can also configure a FUBAR 2000 very easily. And the layout, you can show anything, show a lot of the information about a file and show playlists. There's also, you can show things like here, I have it set up. This is the actual representation of the particular of spectrum of the audio file. This is a representation of the how loud it is at this particular point when I'm playing it. This is the volume control here. You can also do here. You can also choose an equalizer. You can do a whole bunch of other things to the file while you're playing it. There are also a lot of plugins you can add to FUBAR 2000. It's, as you can see from this, it's actively supported and it's actively enhanced as you go along. And you can do other things too. You can do internet radio, YouTube videos. You can do, you can do MP4s. You can run it off DVDs and so on. So it's very useful that way. It's very flexible, but I have not used them. So good luck.
So let's just before you go into the demo, we have a couple of questions in the chat. Bob asks, can you normalize the level of several files in one operation?
Yes. You can level up 1,000 files in one operation if you like.
Okay. Mark Caillé has a question. Any recommendations for locating free audiobooks? And I see Stu has actually replied, looking at LibriVox.org for public domain audiobooks. So if anybody else has other ones, please feel free to plug them into the chat. And then Natalie has a question. Are there any tutorials on the main and basic settings of the program?
I have not seen any tutorials. You could probably search in YouTube. I haven't seen any anything like that. In the links at the end, I have referenced the wiki for FUBAR 2000, but it is it's not well documented. But it is well supported, if that's not a contradiction.
Okay, that's all the questions for now, so take it away with the demo.
Okay, so here is what I've set it up. You can actually specify, you can see all the things here. This is actually looking at all performers that have Eethoven, Beethoven in the thing. So there's lots and lots of files here. You can see as he counted them here, the 124 items, the duration, sample rate, et cetera, et cetera. There's a variety. As you can see, most of them are regular CDs, and something is less at 22,000. But you can also specify what's going to be in each of these panes. This pane has metadata, location, which is where it is on the disk, and general, which is this stuff. If I look over here, this is general twice. I can change that. I can take general out of there. So you can show all this stuff. These are playlists. You can create a new playlist if you want. Library viewer selection is always there, which is what's here. I have a view by file structure, but by folder structure, but you can also do it by a variety of other things. But I always use file structure. If you want to rip a thing, I have a CD that I bought at Blues Fest of Anthony Giracchi. But you're at key. I'm not sure if you define. And if I put it in my CD player, which is, or CD and DVD player, which is attached, I can do file, open audio CD. And I'm ripped. And it's Anthony Giracchi, In the Quicksand Again, which is strange because that's not the title on the, it's called 50 Shades of Blue. So it's awkward. This is not correct. I can look up the title and it does an automatic lookup. If I do, I use from either FreeDB or Music Brains. If I look it up from Music Brains, it doesn't find it. If I look it up in FreeDB, Anthony Giracchi and the Boston Blues, I can update the files. And that's actually the album. Contrary to what's on the disc, which is what showed up before, this is the thing I've seen or accessed from FreeDB, which is a list. They basically take a hash of the one of the files and send it up to them, and they have a list of all the, or not all, but a lot of the files that have been ripped before. And now you can now rip it. Oh, I will just rip two tracks. I haven't ripped this before. This is my first time. So I can rip that using, I want to do CD. Performer, because it's usually a performer. Let's go to the dialogue. This is the converter setup for converting. Output format, destination is is set up, and this is what it's going to be set for. And you can see the title is put in. These are the things you put in to actually specify how it's going to be named. There's processing. I don't want that. CD performer. That's better. So it's now it's V3, which is my preferred thing for doing things like for music. Destination is, as you can see, it's labeled, and I put in the, this is the track number, percent track, and the title. And I go back, processing, I'm not doing any processing on it, and other transfer tags in there, and I can convert. So that's how it looks. I'll go now to the links. So that's how you do things. It's fairly simple, but yet it's very powerful. So I would suggest if you're interested in managing your audio files, this is a very useful thing to do. And if I can turn my phone off.
Tom, there is one other question. Natalie was asking for ripping, is the default usually okay? I sort of said, well, I'd peruse everything the program can do, but do you think that it made, you know, rational choices as the defaults?
No, you have to make the choices yourself. Okay. I would not, this is not a default program. This is a program where you want to take a look at what you want. Okay. You can rip it as a CBR at 320. You can rip it as FLAC. You can rip it as ALAC. You can do a variety of things. And it's a matter of your choices. So you do need to look into audio files and so on. I have my, I've set up my defaults as, or my settings, which I've named, as you can see. So it's something that you want to be able to do. Oh, great. It's something you want to be able to choose to be able to do things, but it's not, you may have to do a bunch of Googling on how things go, but it is very powerful and it's very good. The usual audiobooks that I've ripped, usually they come up at 16 kilobits per second rather than the 64 kilobits that the audiobooks come with. So it's very useful for compressing audiobooks into a smaller time span.
Okay. Okay, I'm now going to mute all and allow people to unmute themselves. So if anybody has any questions, you could either continue in the chat or you can unmute yourself at this point if you have any questions for Tom. And I'll give about 1 minute for people to decide on that before we move on to the next presentation. And as I said, hopefully we'll have some time at the end for additional questions for any of the presentations tonight. So I don't see anybody unmuting themselves, so I'm going to mute all again without the ability to unmute yourself. And our next presenter is going to be Alan, and Alan, you'll have to unmute yourself. There we go.
Okay, thanks, Chris. Should be all ready to go. Right, so everybody's probably heard about spiders and crawlers and bots. Those are the things that people like Mr. Google uses to run around the web and get all that good information. And I'm not so sure that web scrapers are quite so well known. Certainly it was kind of news to me when I came around to this. So first of all, let me just give you a bit of background as to why we're interested in all of this technology. And most of you know that one of my research interests is in vehicle safety, motor vehicle safety. And this is a page from the American government website, their crash test data website. So this is a series of links to information for a single crash test. So, for example, down here, there's a couple of reports, which are PDF files. There's a whole bunch of files here, which are actually the data that comes off the instrumentation in the crash. So things like vehicle acceleration and the deflection of the chest of the dummy, for example. And are all instrumented and recorded as XY data in these files. And I'm only interested in one of these files. Over here, we've got actual slow motion video of the test from a number of different cameras looking at different angles. And here, there are 77 photographs, pre and post, outside the vehicle, pre and post test, outside the vehicle, inside the vehicle. And here you see view all 72 images. So if I click on this link, it pops up a screen with 77 thumbnails. So clearly, if I want to get all this information locally on my computer, I have to click on each link for the PDF file and download it, click on the zip file I want here to download the data, click on every link for the video, click on every right-click on every image, and then say save as. And there's over 100 individual download elements here. So you can see it's not terribly convenient to do this using a mouse. And it's even worse than that because there are more than 9,000 crash tests. So 9,400 times 100 and something elements is a lot of mouse clicks. So maybe we can think about how could we automate that process. And if you Google for things like spiders and scrapers, you'll find all kinds of information. And basically, spiders and crawlers, they run around the web and they find information. And that's what Google's doing. It's running around every website it can find and all the links to all the websites it can find. And then it downloads the information, indexes it, and creates this massive search engine that we all know and love. Now, the question is, how does it actually do this? Well, you and I are used to looking at this. We see a website, we see some text, we see color, we see some links, we see some images, and this is what we see in our browser. But behind the scenes, the browser is actually looking at this. It's looking at a whole bunch of hypertext markup language tags. So it's really one enormous text file, if you like. And the browser is picking out these tags and deciding how it's going to display it. So, for example, on the web page, you will see maybe a link as an underline in blue. That's basically being produced by this piece of HTML code here. And the thing of interest to me right now is this actual URL, because this is what I can use to download this PDF file. So if I go to the NHTSA website, here's our website. This is part of the code. This is how it starts off. And you may recognize this as being initial text in a cascading style sheet type web page. If you scroll down the page a bit, then you get into the meat and potatoes. And this is what we need to decipher if we're going to find the links and download these files. So we have to kind of dig into this a little bit. And let's just look at this line, right? These lines right here were highlighted in yellow. If I pull those up a bit bigger, you can see basically there are some div tags, which are divisions, and they tell us that this is a section of the HTML code. But more importantly, there are some anchor tags, some A tags. And these basically give you a hyperlink which links to something, a web page or an image, or in this case, it's linking to a PDF file. And you'll notice that this text has a title for the file, and it also has the URL for the file. So if we could find those things, that would probably help us. So what do we need to do? Well, what we need to do is build ourselves a web crawler. And the web crawler, it has to browse to a certain web page, and we'll tell it where to go, you know where to go. And then when it gets to that page, it has to go grab all that HTML code. And then we're going to get the crawler or the program to search through that code for us and look for links to PDF files and JPEGs and video files. And then once we've extracted the links, we can actually download the files. So we're going to basically create an automatic system for obtaining this information from this website. Now, how are we going to do that? Well, obviously, what we do is we give Google a call. Hey, Google, you got a couple of programmers you can lend us for a day or two? Build a web crawler? I'm not sure that's going to work. So maybe what we have to do is do it yourself, and maybe what we have to do is build a Python program. And here's your first bit of trivia for the night. Python was developed by a Dutch programmer called Guido van Rossum, and he called it Python because he was a huge fan of Monty Python's Flying Circus. So there you go. If anybody asks you why Python is a programming language, then that's the answer. Right, so Python has some libraries. They call them Python modules. It has one called the Selenium WebDriver, and basically that has a whole bunch of routines that allow us to automate things that we do with web browsers. There's a driver manager, which basically links these web browser operations to a browser, i.e. Chrome in this case. We're going to use the Chrome driver manager. And then finally, there's another module called regular expressions, which when we have a text string, we can actually search through that text string. All right, so we're not going to go into a huge amount of detail in terms of Python programming, but there are two basic operations that we have to do. First of all, we've got to go and get the HTML code. So we have to have a baseline URL, which will get us to the NHTSA website. And then we're going to need to know what test number, so we go to the right page. So we basically set up a URL called crash test, which is pointing to the page that we want. Remember we had that Chrome driver? Driver get on this crash test URL basically says, load the HTML code from the web page. Or actually it doesn't know. It says go to that page, right? Get that web page. And then what we have to do is we have to give a time delay. We just let the program sit there for a second or two to make sure that all the code has been downloaded to the browser. And then we can use another command here, driver.pagesource, which gets the actual HTML code and loads it into a text variable called content. So we basically get all our HTML code and stick it into a text variable. So now we can start searching through that text and finding the links that we want. So what we do is we use this re.search operation to basically get a target string. And then from the target string, we pull out a URL. And then once we have the URL, we go and download the file that's pointing to that URL. And just in case it's a huge file, we do it bit by bit in basically 1024 bytes at a time. And then we write it out to a file. All right, so let's just have a look at how we're actually going to do this search. So here's our code from the actual web page. And here's our research string command. So this first bit is actually the first yellow string. This slash div thing here is the second yellow string. And this part of the research command, this dot star question mark, says, get me all the characters between these two strings and use the content variable, which is the HTML code that we just downloaded from the website. So we basically can find the text between these two strings. And if you look at it, what we're going to do is pull out this piece of code right here. And you can see actually that I've got more information than I told you. I told you I was trying to find a hyperlink. So there's the hyperlink to the zip file. But you notice I've got some other stuff. I've got a target and a slash A tag. And the bit in between there is actually the file description for that zip file. Well, once I've got a text string, I can run the search command again. And I can pull out the text for the hyperlink, and I can pull out the text for the file description, So I got both things. So with the zip file, I can download the file. With the hyperlink, I can download the file, and the file description basically gives me an idea of what it is I just downloaded. And you'll see why that, how we use that in just a minute. So here's what, here's the final result. So here's my, my download folder. And you can see I've got a zip file downloaded, which is that data file that I was telling you about. It's actually a zip file of multiple pieces of data. If you count, I've got 21 WMV movie files, and I've got a whole bunch of JPEG files, which spill down the bottom of the page, and the PDF report files are basically down the bottom end there. So my Python script is actually doing what I said. It's getting the web page code. It's pulling out all the links to the data, the movies, and the images, and it's downloading those files into a folder on my C drive, on my local drive. You also notice I've got this download log.txt file, and the Python script also produces that. And here you can see it's giving me a list of the files that it's downloaded, and it's giving me a list of the file descriptions. And those are really useful because the images, for example, it's just like the number one, number two, number three dot JPEG. And if I didn't know what they were, I'd have to look at all the pictures to find out what I was interested in. But now I can actually read through the file descriptions. And if I'm interested in, you know, the tire placard, then I know I've got to look at number four JPEG, for example. So there we have it. That's basically how scripts work. And that's basically what I think Google is doing. It's sending out its spider, grabbing the code, and then searching through for all of the information that's of use. So now we, you and I now basically know how to do it. So the question I have for you is, anyone going to competition with Google? I think I'm going to need a slightly bigger computer than my laptop here to do the whole internet. So if anybody wants to give me a hand, feel free. That's it for me.
Okay, I'm going to mute all and allow people to unmute themselves if they wish to do so. There's nothing currently in the chat. So if anybody has any questions or comments for Alan, please unmute yourself or throw it into the chat within the next minute or so. I'll just say that, you know, I look at some of that programming aspects of it, and it looks convoluted and terribly difficult to construct these things. But when you think of the proposal that Alan had at the start, when you eliminate, 100,000 clicks of your mouse to accomplish this, maybe it's worth a little bit of effort to script some things. Tom says, is there no way to find when web page completely downloaded rather than wait some number of seconds?
I don't know. If you can tell me how to do that, I'll build it into the program.
Yeah, it's interesting.
So I can change the time delay, until I get something that seems appropriate.
Yeah. It is an interesting puzzle. You know, when is the web server no longer going to send you more information? I don't know if you ever know that.
Yeah, I don't know. It turns out you need to wait about 2 seconds for this particular website, and it takes about a minute to download the whole web page. So waiting a couple of seconds and downloading a whole raft of files in 1 minute isn't a real problem for me.
Yeah.
Because the other thing is I can automate the script. So I actually use Excel and a VBA macro to cycle through crash test numbers. So Excel picks up a crash test number, sends out the command to Python to go download the files, and then cycles through the next crash test number. So in theory, I could do all 9,400 tests and just let it run.
Yeah. Tom mentions that there are some spiders that download complete websites. One thing I'd point out, just having seen Alan's code and output, one thing that wouldn't give you is those descriptions linked to each of the graphics, nice and easy. So yeah, you'd have a copy of the website locally, but you'd still be browsing through the local copy of the website to really do anything. So,
well, if you did what I think Tom's mentioning, you'd actually also have the index.html page, so okay. You could display that on your browser and then wander through and see which link you want.
True. Good. Okay. I don't see any other questions, and nobody's unmuted themselves, so I'm going to mute all. And again, people will not have the ability to unmute themselves. And our next presenter, Bob Harris, and you're going to have to unmute yourself, Bob, and then you can take it away for your part of the presentation.
Well, thank you, Chris, and thank you, Alan. That's impressive. This is a hard act to follow. That is. But very impressive. This is a little more fluffy, this one here is. I'm sure some people here use email. Now, advertisers always know the power of graphics in advertisements, in emails. If it was easy, would you want to use the power of graphics in your emails? Well, I'm here to show you. You can do it, and it certainly is very easy. You can add graphics to your emails using Bitmoji, a customized avatar. Put into your emails, it's quite easy to do. This is available on many platforms. You can use it on your cell phones, very Snapchat. I think it's on Twitter, too. I don't know. But today I'm going to use it in Windows with a Chrome browser using Gmail. That's just how I do it. There are many ways to do this. Let's get into it. So it's certainly easy to create your own avatar. Any of these could be your avatar. Oh, I see in the chat that Stuart's friend's having a birthday today. So, Stuart, I'm sorry your Bitmoji hasn't been set up yet. So let's use my Bitmoji. We'll go to the internet, find a little poem. We'll copy and paste it into our email on Gmail. And see, we have a little avatar in our Gmail now. That's Bitmoji. Click on that, and we'll search Bitmoji. Type the word birthday in here, and our search will automatically change to all birthday-related items. And there's this little handsome guy in all these spots. I see Stuart is pointing this one over here. We can scroll up and down. That there's hundreds of choices in here. Let's pick this one right here. We'll take that one. Pop, zoom, it's in our email. Grab a corner of the sticker. We can resize it. I would suggest that smaller is better than bigger. Don't do a big, huge graphic. Pop, it's in our email, and it takes longer to actually select the graphic than anything else. Okay, excuse me. I see someone just sent me a gift. I'm sorry. I'll send a little note here right now, Bitmoji. We'll pick a little graphic here, and we'll say thank you. Oh, I'm sorry. Excuse me again. A friend just passed an exam. We'll fire a little note off. Congratulations, passing your exam. That's an amazing grade. You're a hard worker, and we'll put a little graphic in there, and away we go. You get the idea. It's easy to insert these graphics. Let's do something a little different. Let's combine Bitmoji with GreenShot. GreenShot is a free screen capture program. Oh, there we go. Don't worry, it's easy. It's not going to be hard. Let's send our friend a note to tell them about the amazing Q&A session on Wednesdays. So we'll go to the website and find the Q&A page here. We'll use GreenShot to copy this graphic. Leave a little white space to the right. So we'll copy that into GreenShot. We have a graphic here now. Next, we'll open our email again, get a Bitmoji from our email. We'll copy this Bitmoji into GreenShot also. So now we have two GreenShot screen captures. Now the merge. We're going to open the larger Q&A graphic and copy the Bitmoji into that one. there we have it done. Of course, in GreenShot, it's very simple to add a speech bubble. So let's do that too. It's easy to do. And we fly away here now. This merge screenshot, we'll open an email right now, put some text in here. We'll copy that merge screenshot right into there, put the link in, and we're done. Is that easy? I'm sure you can all do that. Well, if you don't believe me, let's try it live here. Let's open an email here right now, and we'll do it live. We'll share this email here. Do you see my email here?
Yep.
I'm a very slow typer here, so we're going to do some cheating here. I'm going to do some copying and pasting here. I don't type that well. Here we go. We'll put OPC UG Q&A. We'll put that in here, and we'll delete this. I'll make it a little bigger so you can see it. And I'll make it in blue and a little bigger. You can see that. There, you can see that. So we could send this email off just as it is. Let us make it a little friendlier. So we'll do what I said before. So we're going to change our view here, and I'm going to do this is hard for me on here. I'm going to go to the Q&A webpage here. You should find it right here. We'll use GreenShot. We're going to copy this Q&A graphic right here in GreenShot. Now I'll move that over here in new share. We're going to show you my GreenShot one, which is right here. You should see that now. That's the graphic we just copied. Now I'll go back to the email. New share, email. I'm getting mixed up here. Not yet. We're doing good. I'll find a little graphic from Bitmoji. Click on our Bitmoji icon here. We can scroll down to all these selections of graphics we see. Let's keep it simple here right now. There's one right there. We'll pick that one and make it a little bigger. There we go. We'll take one more green shot of this one now, and we'll copy that. And now I'll show you what I have there. My share screen is going to right there. You'll see should have shared, new share. There, you see that now? Okay, there we go. That's copied. Now we'll copy this graphic, and now we'll switch to the larger graphic. New share to the larger graphic in GreenShot. We'll shift that one here. Now we'll copy the other graphic. It's already in the clipboard. We'll go up here, and we'll put in paste. And there's our other graphic here. For speech bubbles, not a problem. Speech bubble here, we'll add a speech bubble. We'll say, check this out. I spell terribly. Okay, we put that one here. We can change the color of the of this in GreenShot. We want to, it's in black right now. Let's make it a little more friendly. We'll pick the color here. We'll go to, I can't see it because my windows are blocking. There are lots of windows going here. And we'll pick a color. There we go. Make it in red. Okay, check this out. So we'll copy this now. Now we'll switch back to our email. I promise you'll be simple. Go back to our email. Share this screen. There's a little would be before, a little bit before, we'll hit a backspace here, get out of there, and now we will control V, copy it in. As promised, it's done. Fairly simple. You can see you can do this yourself. This is a very simple one. You can get more elaborate. Your imagination is the limit. You can combine things together, and it's better than sending a simple raw text email. It's a lot more friendlier. So you get the hang of that part. Now we'll scoot back to our presentation. And if I get this right here, we're still there. Amazing. Okay, so you want to install Bitmoji? You simply go to bitmoji.com. It says go to my account. You haven't got an account yet, but go ahead to that account. And then when it says click sign up, you click sign up, enter your email address, an easy password. It's not complex. And don't worry, Bitmoji cannot read your email. Now your avatar. The website will guide you. Go through that. You'll pick out your hair color, your chin, your nose, your eyebrows. It's a fun little task. Spend some time with this. There's lots of areas to pick your own exact avatar. It'll walk you right through it. You'll see all the different faces. Pick one like yours. You'll do clothing and such. There's also availability. This is where they make money, I believe. You can put in Nike clothing or Carhartt stuff. It's optional. You don't need to wear that stuff. It's available for you to use, but I don't. Mine is just plain and simple. Now, doing your avatar, it's important to have your picture near you when you do it. Get your own picture, prepare it as you go, and so now your Bitmoji is all set up. The next step, we want to link this to our Gmail account in Windows. That's called installing a Chrome extension. So we're all set up right now. We need to install a Chrome extension here. It's not hard to do. So we need a Chrome extension. We go to the Chrome Web Store. Google search Chrome Web Store. You can't go wrong there. When you finally go to the Chrome Web Store, this is a big ad. Ignore that. You'll see search extensions. You want to find Bitmoji. That in. Ignore the ads. Bitmoji is the first hit. You can't go wrong there either. And it's on this one. It'll say add to Chrome. Yes, we will. You're going to add the extension. And before you know it, you're logged in. And you have Bitmoji now tied to your Gmail account. You can access it with Bitmoji and Gmail. All the avatar, 350 or so. Now, don't worry about paying for Bitmoji. Bitmoji is free for all OPCUG members. Believe it, it's true. You go there, you'll get it for free. You'll have lots of fun in your emails. I used to use Bitmojis in my work in an office environment, not all the time, but emails don't have to be boring all the time. Make it more fun. The graphics can be discreet. Don't make a big, huge, large graphic. A small accent can do a whole lot for your email. Have fun and enjoy.
Okay, Bob, thanks. Natalie had a question. Will this work well with other browsers? I've had issues with some things being incompatible with Firefox and Mozilla.
I would assume so, yes. I mean, I have it on a smartphone also. The only thing I can't do, I can't resize the graphics. They come into one size only. In the Windows format, I like to resize the graphics so it doesn't dominate the... But it's used. It's widely used. I'd mention also there's also a Bitmoji Deluxe. Gives you more opportunities to, if you move up further, more chances to buy fancier clothes. But they're all optional. The clothes aren't required. It's a fun program. It's free. I can't say how quick it is. I one more example. I won't do it now. It takes a little longer. But I have one more example to show you guys. But it just takes a little slower. And you can copy and paste. Now, GreenShot is a screen capture program. I think Chris uses Snagit. Equally fine, yeah. I'm sure, also. It's a fun program. Give it a try and have fun.
Linda has a question. Does the site use your pick, or is it just for your own reference?
There is one opportunity to use your picture, but no, I didn't use that. But the key part is have your graphic in front of you. Don't just go by memory. When you pick your eyes, pick your nose, pick your ears, having yours in front of you, you'll quickly go through. It won't take long at all. Before you know it, you'll have your own graphic. You can do your own body, too.
I don't think you know.
Mine is a little slimmer than my actual body is. No one's called me on it yet. But it's all your choice.
One hint I'll give in terms of installing to different browsers, because it's in the Chrome Web Store, it looks like it'll only, you know, it's designed to work in Google Chrome. But if you go to it with any Chromium-based browser, including, say, for example, the latest iteration of Microsoft Edge, if you go to the Chrome Web Store, it'll say add to Chrome, but if you go to the Web Store using Edge, it'll actually install it as an extension into the Edge browser or whatever Chromium-based browser you're using. So it should actually work in any Chromium-based browser, all the extensions.
I would say it would work. I have a smartphone. It isn't an Android, the other one. And I put a Bitmoji app on that one, and right away my Bitmoji format popped into the same one, the same stickers in my phone also.
Yeah. Natalie had a question. Is GreenShot free versus Snagit not free? Yeah, that's right. GreenShot is 100% free. They'll happily take donations, but you're free to use it at no charge at all. Snagit definitely is not a free app.
Well, GreenShot is free to all OPCUG members. I didn't mention this, but everyone else gets it free too.
Yeah. And I think that's all the questions, but I will, just for consistency, I will mute all with the ability to unmute yourself. So if there is anybody who has any questions before we move on to our next topic, unmute yourself now or throw the question into the chat window. I'll give a few seconds. Tom answers that ShareX is more powerful.
Is Bitmoji it's just bits, it's just raster rather than being like SVG, a vector kind of thing?
I don't know, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure they are strictly bitmaps. Because one of the things I've noted with Bob's is they can't get rather large. So it's definitely not a vector based, thing. So they would be bitmaps. Okay. We have nobody else unmuting themselves and no more questions in the chat. So I'm going to mute all. And again, nobody will have the ability to unmute themselves except for Timothy. You can unmute yourself because you are our next presenter.
Hello. Okay. Share screen. Okay. Can you see my screen?
Yep, but you're not in screen slideshow mode. We're seeing your thumbnails and all the rest of it.
Okay, let's get there.
That looks good.
And I might get rid of that. Okay. Tonight I'm going to talk about genealogy and some of the software that I've been using. And I'm going to be showing some stuff that I found on the internet for my own family. So let's start. First off, before genealogy, before computers, people would write in the Bibles, or they would stick some notes in the Bibles. Some would draw trees and notes, manuscripts. Some would use ancestor tablets, and some of the information would be by word of mouth. This is a form of, instead of using a tree, they would use this ancestor table that was created in Germany about 200 years ago. And your parents would be considered number 2 and 3. Their parents would be considered 4 and 5. And your mom would be considered 6 and 7 and so on, as in this example here. In 1885, William Henry Whitmore created the book called The Ancestral Tablet. It was a collection of the diagrams for pedigrees so arranged so that 8 generations could be shown in a more picturesque setting. It would allow up to 8 generations, which would contain 255 people, including the person who descendants or the ancestors would be related to. Generation 1 would be you, and generation 8 would be your 5th grandparent. The book would start in the center. You would be number 1, my dad, on this side of the book would be your father, and on this side of the book will be the family from your mom's. My dad would be here, and my mom would be here. Now, the book has some missing parts of it so that you can go to another branch of the tree. So if I went to my dad's mom, my dad will appear on this page, and my dad's mom, father would be here, and his grandmother or great-grandmother would be here, and so on, up to 8 generations. You can't see on this side, but on this side would be my mom's side, but for here, the pages would be blank. So you can write on it. You can stick on paper, notes. You can put on photographs. And this little square is 2 centimeters by 4 centimeters in size. So you would have to write not too big to put in the name, the full name. You have to put in the birth date, marriage date, and death date. And I have a copy here from the net where somebody had, this is the mother's side, and someone had put in some pictures and some their own notes here. Now, where do you find the information? Well, a lot of times is where I said how people were storing the information before. In the Bibles, in my Bible, I got from my grandmother, she had a lot of newspaper clippings. The family tree drawings I found in archives. Notes, some in archives too. I had other family members with family trees. And some word of mouth from family members. You can also find the information to go further back. Churches, cemeteries, cities, towns, townships, provincial, state, and national archives. You can also find some information in newspapers and the obits. Now, this is a family tree that I took a picture of from my aunt. And this was made in 1975 over in England. So it's not a bad tree at all. This is called a this is the pedigree chart. We start with the person. Your ancestor would be the great-grandfather on one of my mother's side. You have then their kids and their kids' kids and their kids' kids. Now, this side has all the dates and death dates. But on this side, I had blanked out the birth dates because if you're going to publish some information on the web, you do not want to show the actual birth dates of people because of identity theft nowadays. So I just blanked that out. And this one is from another cousin who actually published part of the family on my mom's side. He wrote a book, and here's part of the tree that that my mom belongs under. Half the family here came from Ireland in the 1830s into the Peel region. And this group here came from Germany, and this group here settled in America in Buffalo, New York, but later on, my grandfather met my grandmother. Now, here's a sample of my family tree on my dad's side. This one came from the Perkins Bull Collection in Brampton. It's the Pearl Region archives. This was done in the 1930s by William Perkin Bull. And this is more of a close-up of what it would, how he did it. Alexander Hillock came, married Catherine Daly. And I can go back to Ireland as far as 1790 when Alexander was born. And rumor has it from the archives that he had a brother, and maybe another brother, or it could have been a cousin. And they settled in the Peel region as well. So basically, most of my family line came from the Peel region. And I found a lot of information in the Brampton archives. And who was William Perkins Bull? Well, he was a self-made individualist and historian who in the 30s sent out teams of 100 people to gather information from the families of the early settlers of the Peel region. And interviewed a lot of people, or his people interviewed a lot of people. They got some response back, and you can have a lot of information from your side of the family if you had family living in the Peel region, or you might get a little bit. But they have a lot of information, and he generated most of the information for the Peel region. So he has his own archive down there. But you have to keep in mind, some of the information may not be accurate, as there are some members missing from the family tree that I showed you, of my family tree. And some of the information is incorrect. And you have to remember that some of the names might be similar to your ancestors, but they may not be your ancestors. So you have to keep that in mind. And he had typed up all the documents that he got from his people. They put it into booklets. And I had a Captain Charles Hare. He was born in Port Credit in 1826. Shortly, his father was named Peter Hare. I had checked that out after with my research. And a lot of this information on Captain Hare and his family is correct, because my great-great-grandfather is the son of Charles Hare. So he could verify all the information as he was still alive in the 1930s when Bull was gathering all this information. In the 70s, kits were created for people to help who were interested in genealogy. And this kit had a 2x3 family tree that you would fill out by yourself. And there was also papers to show the ancestral lineage, or pedigree now it's called. And this is how you would fill it out. You would put in the person's name, like George W. Hillock. You put in the date of his birth date, where he was born, and then the date he died. And some of the information I have and some of the information I don't, so that's why some of this kind of looks not filled in. And this form here, it's a family chart. And you would have the parent's name here, and their parents would be below here. And then this would be the kids of the parents on here. And you would write in the information of where they were born, the date, and who they married, the person they married would be on this side. And on this sheet, you would write the information of, like, if you found a chart or something else, you would write it here, like I did the old family tree from the Perkins Bull collection. And they also produced some hardcover books, blank, of course, that you would go and fill in all the information. And some of the pages were small, so you had to write or type the best you could. Now, in the computer age, in the 70s, microcomputers were being produced, and some of them were winding up in homes. So people started to create their own programs to save their family tree information. computer magazines started to be published. Simple programs were being created for shareware. Some were also free. And in 1979, two computer magazines, Personal Computing and Byte, were the first known magazines to publish copies of the geology program. Personal Computing had Tracing Your Family Tree, The Roots and Branches by John Armstrong. He wrote it, his program on a system TRZ-80. And in The Byte, written by Stan Murrow, he did it on a DEC system 2050 at the University of Chicago. So I guess he had a lot of spare time to do that at work. And of course, by the mid-80s, there were many shareware, freeware, and software companies creating programs. By 2020, many are still around, but some have fallen, the products that is. Corral had created their own family tree suite, and they even created another program to read a file system called GEDCOM, and I will talk about that in a few minutes. And as of yesterday, Corral has officially changed its name to AllDoAll. Now, all the programs by the mid-80s were saving their information in different formats, so it made it incompatible to give your data from to different family members. They either had to have the same program that you were using to save your information, or they had to re-enter in the data. And at one point in the early 80s, some programs decided to read in the data file from other programs. But they didn't read them all. Most of the major software companies started to do that, but they didn't read all of their competitors. And also, companies with requests from their customers wanted to save more and different types of data. So things over time got a little out of hand, and when they were importing or exporting data, some of the data was lost due to different styles of how they save and record and distribute the data. Well, what to do? Well, one of the answers was the introduction of GEDCOM. And that was, what is GEDCOM? GEDCOM is an acronym for Genealogy Data Communication. What this was is the computer, the program would generate the data from the tree into a text file that the next program would be able to read correctly. But it was made more to be read by computers and not by people. This type of data transmission was created by the Church of Latter-day Saints, the LDS, aka known as the Mormon Church. The original GEDCOM specs, number one, was released in 1984, and the latest was just released in near the end of 2021. Now, most standards programs today have the standard of 5.51. However, even with the standards, some of the standards were stopped in 1998 by the church, and nobody updated them for 20 years until a group decided to update the standards. By the time in 2019, things were getting a little bad because each manufacturer would add some stuff to this, to what they call the standards, and the standards allowed this, but not all manufacturers would do the same thing. So they all had their own little standards that other programs could not understand, so data again was lost. So now they're trying to make it once and for all, make everybody understand the same thing. And this time really follow the standards. Even the LDS group did not do the same in their programs. They didn't sometimes didn't even follow their own standards. And this is what the data would look like. Now, Philip Brown created a system called the Family History System in 84, and he was the only one at the time known to be able to read the first version. The LDS who created the version only released version 2 of GEDCOM in their system called PATH, which was version number 2. They did have a version number 1, but it didn't have the ability to read and write GEDCOM. And this is what the versions from 2 and up kind of look like. And as I said, you have to understand, you may look at this and you say, what is that? I don't understand. Even though some of the words you kind of know what they are. It's like phone, name, address. And this would tell you this is the source where the data was coming from, like the family history system. And destination should be the program that you want to send it to. It could have been family history system number 97. It could have been Family Tree Maker or Roots Magic. Now, I currently use the programs Family Tree Maker, Roots Magic, and Heritus. Now, FGM allows you to sync your tree from a computer to a tree online through Ancestry.com. Now, this is a pay site. Sorry, Alan. The website will, time to time, find out what could be possible, hints to your family members. You can also search using Ancestry and Alias Family Search website from within the program. Now, the Family Search website is free. Roots Magic allowed you to create CDs of your family tree to give out to members. They were able to review but not be able to make changes. And at one time, they had an app that you could use on your phone or tablet, and you could scroll through it to see if you were away somewhere and you said, oh, do I have – and at an archive or anywhere else, and you say, do I have this person? Then you can go through and see if you did. And Heritus has an app for the phone and tablet as well. And I forgot to mention, Roots Magic only allowed for viewing and no changes on the go. Heritus has an app for the phone and tablet. And in this one, you can make changes on those devices. Afterwards, you would have to transfer all the data back onto your computer. Now, this is.
Are you getting near the end, Timothy? You're well over your 20 minutes.
Oh, I am? Oh, okay. Well, this is a screenshot of Family Tree Maker. This is Roots Magic. This is Heritus. This was the app for Roots Magic. And this was Heritus. What to do with your family tree? Well, you can put them in binder. You can publish in a book like my cousin did. You can donate to your local historical society if possible. Now, you would have to call them before you drop off your information because they may not have storage or they may not have the storage or people to look at the information you have. Now, I guess I wanted to show, I guess I'm running out of time. Okay. Now, I use the computer. I can print the information instead of writing onto paper as I had in those kits. Makes it easier and neater to write. Sometimes my writing or printing can not be as very good. Here's a chart I have it in a legal size binder, and this one's ledger size, and this is legal size. You can put your information in binders like that or a regular size binder. So links for the standards. If you want to read about the standards for GEDCOM, you could these are some websites for it. And some links for the free forums. If you want to gather information from family members, you can go to these sites, grab some the free forms, and you can give them out to your family. You can have them fill it out. They give it back to you, and they can enter it into your computer system. Now, family tree is here. I have one branch of my family, and you can do many things. You can store the information. This is my great-grandfather and his wife, and you can see his her mother and father. And here is a blank, it's a silhouette of a picture, but if I add a new picture, I can take the picture, open, copy it, yes, okay.
I'm going to have to give you the hook there, Timothy.
Okay. I'll just fly. I know. I tried to make it interesting, and maybe I got too much.
Yeah, that's good. We do have a couple of questions in the chat. How do you manage divorces and stepchildren?
Okay. Go
very
to
quickly.
Person. Yeah, person. Attach. Where is it? Attach. Home place. Tools. Oop. Person. Come on. Slow. Preferred. Try not to change. There was a code here. What you select, you can make them a stepmother, stepfather, all the relationships. Like here I have mother biological, preferred, wrong place. You can change it. I have changed it, but not that many times.
Okay. And we have a question from Tom, if there is any DNA connections.
There are DNA connections with the file, but I haven't used any DNA, so I'm not familiar with how to load it up, but you can load it up to the Ancestry website and also into your program. So you can sync your desktop to the Ancestry.com.
Okay. Natalie commented that info gathering, she got help from the Ottawa Public Library to track down documents, immigrant boat arrivals, marriage certificates, etc. Their genealogy experts are very helpful and get free access to paid databases through the Ottawa Public Library. That's handy. Stu mentions, my family has been using the Genie website for a decade or so. It's kind of wiki-type thing where people invite other family in and everyone adds information into it.
Yeah, that's something like the family history from the LDS community. They used to be able to add your own tree, but then they combine them all into one big tree so people can go on and add things. But sometimes they add the wrong things, then you have to go back in and change it. So that's probably like the wiki.
Okay, we are running late, so I'm going to cut it off there, and we can have free-form discussion after all the presentations when everybody is free to leave if they don't need to participate in that part. So I'm going to take over and share my screen, and there we go. Okay, so my presentation is on photo restoration using GFP-GAN. And I found out what GFP stood for, and I forget what it is, but I never could find out what GAN stands for, that portion of it, so I didn't bother putting in what it's an acronym for. So the site says that they restore old photos using their photo restoration application built with, based on and powered by a particular AI model. And that's sort of important that it's just an implementation of a particular AI model. It is free, so it's all web-based, and you can go to the website, and I have the URLs there, and I'll paste those into the chat window later. There is no user control for using this particular implementation for it. You upload an image, and the site does what it's going to do to the photo, and you have no control over what it does or doesn't do. It does work best with images of people. For images that you have that are not people-based or don't have people in them, there's minor improvements to other types of photos, mostly just in noise reduction. I'll show some examples of that. So this is a particular implementation of a project that's available on GitHub. If you're a programmer, you could go in and you could take a look at their AI model in detail. This is the only implementation I know of that particular model. And there is more information at Petapixel that has talks about how this came about and some interviews with the author of the model and so forth. So in terms of the support for what you can actually send into there and what you get out, common picture formats are supported. So JPEG and TIFF are the most likely formats you're going to come across, especially with pictures of people and things like that. But I also did test it with other image types, including bitmap, GIF, PNG, and WebP, and it handled those all without any problems at all. In terms of maximum resolution, I didn't run into a maximum resolution. The highest resolution I have for an actual digital camera is 42 megapixel Sony A7R III camera, so about 8,000 pixels by 5,300 pixels in size. And I then tested it also with a TIFF file that I had, which is 122 megapixel, so over 14,000 by over 8,000 pixels in size, and it handled those no problem at all. There is no support for RAW format, which is very common in especially the more high-end digital cameras. I tested it with Nikon, Canon, and Sony RAW formats, and it wouldn't deal with any of them. When you get a restored image, what you will get is a PNG file. Now, this is part of where this is an implementation of a particular model. The model itself is pretty agnostic to things like output file formats and maximum resolutions and things like this, but it's just in this particular implementation, they will output a PNG file. It will output a maximum of 2,800 pixels, either on width or height. Is maximum 2,800. And if you have smaller images than 2,800 pixels, it will actually upscale the image up to 2 times, again, to the maximum of 2,800 pixels. So let's look at some examples here. So this is an image I have. This was actually a scanned 35 millimeter negative for a photo I took probably over 45 years ago. So on the left is the original, and then the right is what the implementation of this particular model came up with. So if we look at some of the things that I notice in there, we remove some stray hairs in the forehead. It cleaned up the whites of the eyes so you don't see the red blood vessels and that. It emphasized the eyelashes a little bit. And it modified the catch lights in the eyes, which I thought was kind of curious because when I shot it, I had a very simple light setup. And I thought the catch lights were quite fine with that, but the model decided to modify the catch lights. It ended up with an artifact where we had that highlight on the skin, and it didn't know what to do with, and it made a mess of it a little bit there. Thinned the lips down a little bit, and I find that it smoothed the skin texture to a somewhat plasticky look to it, and this is actually fairly typical of this particular model. Overall, I think it did well. There are a couple of things that it messed up on, but it did quite a good job, and I think most people would be happy with the output from that. This is one that I thought was really, really good, and this is actually from a scanned photograph that probably dates back, about 40 years or so, and you can see the original on the left and on the right. It's amazing the quality of the output from it, and it sharpened up the facial features, so we look at the nostrils, the lips, the eyes. They've all been sharpened really, really well. Removed grain from it. It didn't do anything really with any of those white spots that were on the photograph. However, that's easy to deal with. I just loaded the photo into any photo editor that can do either cloning or content-aware erasure, and I used on one photo raw about 2 minutes of editing and ended up with a really, really nice output from it. I think that was a spectacular example of what can be done with this particular AI model. here's a picture of one of my nieces going back about, I think it's about 19 or 20 years. And it was taken with a very low megapixel camera. And you can see that there was a lot of grain in it and so forth. And it removed all of the noise from the image. It sharpened up the facial features very well, sharpened up the hair. And I think that was another example of a very successful restoration using this particular model. Here's my son from about 19 years ago. And some of the things I noticed on it was, first off, it did remove the red eye. So in the actual pupil, you see in the original where it's red, and it's cleaned that up quite well. It cleaned up the whites of the eyes, so we get rid of those veins in the eyes. It de-emphasized his eyelashes a little bit, especially if you look along the bottom of his eye. You can see that it has removed quite a few of those eyelashes there. And it did reduce that reflection of the light in the glasses. One thing I found curious, it removed all of the freckles on it. And it also gave that somewhat plastic-looking skin with it being overly smoothed out. I gave this a sort of middling. The reason why is that freckles, removal of freckles could be a very personal thing. Some people might think that removal of freckles really takes away part of the characteristics of who this person really is. If you don't mind it, then it does a good job. If it if you think that they should be left in, it did a bad job. Here's another image, and this one was actually curious too. This is Michael again from about the same time period. And one thing I found interesting is that it removed the upper eyelashes above the glasses there and over there. It removed them in the restoration part of it. And what I found really curious was that it really changed the teeth. And so if you look comparing the left mouth and the right mouth, you can see how it changed the teeth in a couple of fairly significant areas. And again, this is something that it may be removing some of the character of that particular person. You might not object to it. Some people might not even notice, but just realize that that sort of thing can happen. So again, because of that removing characteristics of things like freckles, changing teeth, and so forth, I gave it a middling score. It might be okay, it might not. Here's my brother acting a little bit goofy in a car, pretending like he's going into a crash. And the things that I notice in here, it sharpened up the glasses considerably. It sharpened up the eyes. One of the things that I found really interesting was that if you look above the pupil or the iris in the eye, it actually removed it and put in an eyelid in that portion, which really, I think they did a very bad job of doing that. It also removed some of his teeth. So if we look over here, you don't see his actual teeth. And to me, again, it smoothed the skin to somewhat plastic appearance to it. So I think that did a failed job on that one. I don't think it did a very good job of photo restoration on that. Again, you have no control over it. You put in the photo, you get back the restored image. It doesn't cost you anything, but you can't control what it does. Now, in terms of what it actually does and why these things can come up a little bit, maybe not what you really want. This is a quote from it, the article at Petapixel, and it talked about the restored images don't represent the actual image. So it's an AI model that is filling in some things and is making guesses. And most of the time, the guesses are really good. Sometimes not so much. So the AI really looks at facial details. Okay, so it's looking for those eyes, mouth, and nose, and it's trying to sharpen them up and clean up those parts of the image. The system then looks at the whole image and tries to see, did it really have an end result that looks like the same person? And they actually say the restored images can have, and they quote, a slight change of identity. So this is where you can get changes in teeth. You can get changes where freckles are removed and things like that. And it's just part of the AI model. So I just picked up a couple of other images off of the web of old photos, just to see what it would do with them. This one, I think it did a pretty good job. It reduced the noise. It smoothed out the skin, maybe a little bit too much, but not too bad. It sharpened up the facial features. If you look at her teeth, her eyes, her nose, it sharpened up those features really quite nicely. It did change the catch light in the eyes, which I found a little bit interesting. But overall, I think that was a success. Here's another one where a photo that was cracked and so forth. So in this one, again, it reduced the noise and it smoothed out the skin. And it did a really good job of sharpening up the facial features, the eye, the nose, the mouth, the teeth, and so forth. It really sharpened those up. It did remove a couple of the cracks. So, if we look at the crack that is going across the nose, that got removed. Some of the cracks that are around on the forehead, got removed, but an awful lot of the cracks were actually left in. And so what it restored, I think it did a very good job on. It would still require a fair amount of work to clean up those extra bits on there, which probably would not be terribly difficult using a content aware, erasing tool or a cloning brush in any photo editor. Overall, I think it did a very good job on that. Then I threw at it some non-people photographs just to see what it would actually do. And in this case here, this bird on this rock didn't really do very much of anything. It smoothed and lightened the background slightly, but overall really didn't do very much. So I give it a neutral that it didn't do any harm, didn't do any good. Here's a photo I have of when we were coming into, say, Dísafjörður in Iceland. And so that's the original photograph. And so what I did was I took it into a photo editor and I gave it some problems. So I added some grain. I added some textures to look like it was like stained with watermarks or something like that. And I added a vertical fold that is going down the middle of the photograph there. And then I fed that into the model. And what it came up with was that it reduced the grain quite a bit overall. It softened the texture very slightly and the fold very slightly, but not much of anything really happened beyond the grain reduction. And so again, on that, I just gave it a neutral. So my overall conclusions on it, it is highly tuned to faces for sure. So it's designed specifically for portraits. It smooths the skin. And generally speaking, I find that it smooths the skin more than I would prefer. Some of the people might like it that way, but I think if people's character in their face, to my mind, you don't want to smooth that out to make it look too plastic. It does sharpen up features quite well, and generally overall, I find that it does a pretty good job. It does reduce the digital noise, whether it's on faces or whether it's in the background and so forth, but it does very little to actually improve anything in non-people images. But it's free, so why not give it a try? It just takes a couple of seconds for it to do it, and you may find that it gets you part of the way in doing restoration of photographs that otherwise might be just tossaways. So that's it. That's all I have.
I'm talking of part way, Chris. Tom says, have you tried resubmitting updated images, especially cracks?
Yeah, I tried that on a couple of occasions, and it didn't do anything to improve things the second or third time around. Really, what the model does, whatever it's doing, when it leaves cracks in there, it's not going to do it no matter how many times you ask it to deal with it. Any other questions?
Okay,
then I guess let's I'll just stop here and I'll stop share for a moment and I will mute all with the ability to unmute yourself. So if anybody has any questions or comments or anything like that for any of the presentations tonight, that is the last one that we have on the agenda for tonight, feel free to unmute yourself and ask away. Or, Tom asked for links, and I do have the links for my portion of the presentation. And they are now in the chat window as well. I didn't get Timothy's links ahead of time, so I don't have those pasted in. All of the presentation files will be going up on our website. probably a couple of days from now. And so they will be in the previous presentations section on our website. So does anybody have any other questions before we wrap up our session for tonight? And I don't hear anybody. So what I will do then is I'm going to reshare. Actually, before I do, I'm going to share this. I'll actually show it. This is the actual website. And so if you go there, you come down and there's a section here for where you choose a file. And so what you do is you click on there, you select a photo, you click on open, and then it'll come in and it'll say the photo. Sometimes it loads right away. Sometimes it takes a while to actually load. And sometimes like this, it doesn't seem to do anything. All you do at that point is click on the restore photo. And then I actually see the original. And you can see up here, there's the circle going around saying that it's working on things. Usually when that finishes, you'll see the restored image pop in there. And there we got it. If it doesn't, once that comes back to saying restored photo, even if this doesn't show the restored photo, you can click on download the restored image, and then it'll open up in a new tab in your browser, and then you can right-click save image as, and you can save it however you want, wherever you want on your computer. Notice that it will be a PNG file, and it will be maximum 2400 pixels on each dimension. So that's a really quick look at the actual website. Really quite easy to use. Just keep in mind that idea that sometimes it doesn't show things and you just have to press on with the restored photo and press on with the downloaded restored image. Okay, with that, I will come back to the wrap up. So just a reminder that the October meeting is going to be on general computer hardware. We're going to have a couple of people from the Trailing Edge come out talking about all kinds of aspects of computer hardware. And seeing as they run a computer store that deals with older hardware and so forth, this would be a really good opportunity for anybody to ask questions about what can be done with older hardware and that sort of thing. So that'll be on October 12th, 7:30 p.m. Until then, we have our Q&As. The next Q&A will be next Wednesday night at September 28th at 7:30 p.m., 7:30 to 8:30. And if you have any questions, answers, or topics that you want dealt with, please send them into the email address suggestion box at opcug.ca. And with that, we are done for the evening. So if the presenters wanted to hang around for just a little bit longer in case somebody else comes up with some additional questions or comments or anything like that. But outside of that, I will call it an end to the evening. And thank you very much, everybody, for showing up.
Just one comment. Chris, next week is the 21st. That slide was from my deck for next week.
Oh, okay. Good on you.
Sorry about that.
No problem. And thank you very much to all of the presenters for all of the work they put in for giving the presentations. I highly encourage anybody in the user group to think about whether they can share some information about something they use that makes things fun or easy or whatever, in terms of either computer software, hardware, or services that you use. I know that everybody has their own little tricks and tips and things they use, and why not share it with your other members? And you can see it's not terribly difficult. We look to anywhere from a 10 to 20 minute presentation. We can help you out with slides if need be. You can share your screen to do demos, whatever floats your boat.
One question in the chat for you, Tim. Can you suggest one genealogy software for the casual user?
Suggest one? Well, yeah. Roots Magic has a free version for Windows. It allows most of the features that the full version has. And for Linux, there's one called, I think it's called Gramps.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Which is free as well. But I had a lot of information of just getting into showing what the programs I have used.
Well, good, you can do a session on computer programs and genealogy. Then you don't have to do the basic introductory stuff.
Feel free to do it at Q&A.
While doing my family search, I also use the newspapers.com to get at papers in the States. And I found out that one branch of the family, they were a little not nice. They tricked some people into sponsoring a mine full of gold. They peppered it, or salted it.
Yeah, I guess you never know once you go down that rabbit hole what you're going to find, eh?
Oh, yeah. I even found a picture of my dad as a Brinks guard.
Oh, cool.
20 years old.
Okay, I think that's it, folks. So I'm going to close off the call. So thanks again for everybody for showing up.
Thank you all.
We'll see you all hopefully at Q&A next week.
All right, everyone.
Okay, nice.
Thanks, guys.
And Chris, it went by fast.
Yeah, I know. That is the way it goes.
Well, good job, Kim.
Thank you. I was a little nervous. First presentation, first time using PowerPoint. Have a good night, everybody.
Thanks, good day.
Good night. Thank you. Great presentations.